aren't equal, and so the scope of practice of one may vary somewhat from the other based on their competency. Remember, this is competency-based. And then the third thing they do is they develop a CE program for them, so that if there are areas that need to be developed, they get continuing education. So really those three things happen during that preceptorship. And I would say the very minimum has been 400 hours. That's what the standards say, but I would say on average they're probably closer to 6 months, the dentist forming that relationship.
You had a question, yeah.
We heard a presentation earlier today about the unmanageable child. And I'm wondering whether up in Alaska where there may be a feeling of familiarity that the children are really not unmanageable.
I don't know whether he's asking, do they have unmanageable children in Alaska in the same way that you heard about earlier today. I don't really know how to answer that, but I will tell you that when you're dealing with children as dental patients in their community, some of the management is different. I saw a wonderful dentist dealing with a very upset child in a village, happened to be the one you saw there who talked about why. And his strategy was, it was beautiful to see. The child had three siblings with her, and he laid the other siblings on the dental chair around her, and they stroked her, and she was laughing by the time it was all over. So I think the principles might be a little different. It was fascinating to see. Wouldn't that be great?
I think there's a huge advantage to having a cost-effective provider that can take the amount of time it takes to work with small children and doesn't feel obligated to... you know, we're not tying any of this to productivity. It's tying to accomplishing the goals, and I think there's a lot of advantage to these dental therapists being out there full time, and they can work on one tooth at a time for fearful children, and they can, we were describing, they can take their time and do things that might not otherwise be possible in a productive or high production dental clinic.
Myron.
As a result of being involved in this program, are you incorporating oral health into your PA program, or do you always have oral health?
We began incorporating oral health into our program about 6 years ago. And so this actually, because of that, was another reason we were more open to do this. Well, I think we teach them a different kind of mouth exam, particularly because one of the things that happens is PAs may be working in urgent care, emergency medicine, where folks show up with oral pain. And then there's a lot of prevention included in the maternal child health course as well, appropriate referrals, that sort of thing. So, and I think pretty much PA programs in general and nurse practitioner programs, they're moving toward doing that, which is a good thing. Yes? I think the remote the mechanism is simply that that's where they're from. They hate being in Anchorage. They're under a lot of pressure. It's their home. As a matter of fact, the biggest problem is the opposite. While they're in school, they're constantly being pulled back. If there's a crisis in the village, a crisis in their family, something about these individuals is often that they're often the leader in the family or their healthcare leader. So I can't imagine that they wouldn't want to go. And they're usually married already, so they're not going to marry an urban person. All the issues that happen for medical and dental students, because of their age and because of where they are, those are all fine, aren't in place for this group of people who critically want to get back home. There is a contractual agreement. I think it's a two-year payback or something. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, it's a two-for-one. It's a four-year.
Four-year payback.
They have a four-year obligation to a specific place.
Yes.
Let me just follow up on that question. Am I correct to think that when they become therapists, other than this program, they have no place else to go, right?
At the moment, yeah.
Okay.
But actually, we've had that issue with the people that were health aides that we've trained as physician assistants. We trained 47 of them from villages, and they now are the supervisors of some of those 550 health aides. And I think there's of those 47, there's only one person who's not still in Alaska. So, thank you.
Thank you. to talk about policy planning for dental health aides in Alaska using discrete event simulation modeling. We have a joint presentation by Ben and Brian Saylor. Ben Saylor is a researcher with the UAA Institute of Social and Economic Research, and he's a graduate of the McAllister College, where he studies computer science and music. And thank you for helping with me with the computer. In addition to his work in energy use and experimental economics, Ben is a player of Irish and traditional music, electronic music composer, and juggler. Dr. Brian Saylor has been active in Alaskan health affairs since 1974. He is active in the American Public Health Association, serving on the executive board and the Finance Development and Awards Committee. He is a member of the AJPF editorial board. Saylor has been involved with the Alaska affiliate for many years. He served as president of the Alaska Public Health Association in 1976, 1991, and 2005.
This is fun. This is the first time Ben and I have done a tag team, so bear with us. When I did the work with ICER, I was the director of the Institute for Circumpolar Health Studies, so we've kept that academic affiliation on the slide. I'm retired now, so that affiliation is not there anymore. Ben is still with ICER. The learning objectives were in the abstract that we submitted. In general, we want to talk about the value of this mathematical model in doing policy planning. We'd like to talk about how it incorporates the clinical and administrative parameters that will allow a new system to evolve more quickly, and then talk at some length about the advantages and disadvantages of doing policy planning using discrete event simulation modeling. First, to set the stage for this, Ron and ANTHC came to ICER, to the Institute for Social and Economic Research, with a pretty much impossible request. The idea, the idea was to evaluate the dental health aid program when, as Ron mentioned, there were six practicing dental health aides and they'd been in the field for a few months. Clearly, there was insufficient longitudinal data to do any kind of systems assessment. There was little outcome data, and we're very happy that a group is coming in, RTI is coming in to help better understand the ability of the dental health aides to provide these services. So we had very little information to go on. What we finally decided to do was to create a system, a virtual system, a mathematical model of a community, of a provider, of a series of relationships, and using literature to begin to derive the expected outcomes on a community level. We know that oral decay takes time. It doesn't happen tomorrow. It happens gradually over a number of years. And so we wanted to age this population using a simulation technique for 20 years. So people in this model, and Ben will describe it, are born, they die, they age a year at a time, they seek behavior, seek oral health services and whatnot. As both Ron and Ruth have talked about, the emphasis that we placed on professional judgment in a collaborative model was invaluable. An awful lot of lessons from the multiple years of experience in many countries that use this type of provider were very helpful in establishing the parameters of the model, but we really didn't know how it related to the Alaskan environment until we talked to Ron and a lot of his dental colleagues around the state of Alaska, and they helped us refine these. We'll get back to model tuning in just a bit. Last, this is not a prediction. It's a policy model that allows people that are deploying this new group of providers to anticipate the effects of changes in the delivery system. scope of practice, amount of time, the focus on one population or another, and then to run these through a mathematical model for 20 years in about 2 minutes and find out what the effect is. If it's not the desired effect, you change the parameters, you run it again. So I think as a it's not a predictive model. It's, I think, more more valuable as in the realm of policy analysis.
First, I'm going to try to explain a little bit about what discrete event simulation modeling is. It's a computer modeling technique, and it's a way of studying the behavior of a real-world system by building a computer model of the system. And this model consists of entities flowing through a system using resources, or which is, in this case, analogous to having access to care. And everything happens along a discrete timeline, which is of any length you choose. Events are scheduled continually along this timeline as the model runs. And so there's no inherent time step in the model. It's always you move to the next event as scheduled. You can also observe these models as they run. In the software we use, which is called AnyLogic, you can create an animation that will show the internal state of the model as it runs. And you can also generate output that you can look at the end, graphs, for example, of the oral health of the population. And hopefully they'll educate you about how the real system works to some degree.
Ron started with a very, very pared down description of how the system works. This is just a step up from that, but we know that we have in this model descriptors about the population, the demographics of the population. We know something about their oral health status going in. We have some basic data about the number of treatments that are provided and their relative effectiveness. We know what dental health aides do. We know in some cases that the patient's condition exceeds the capacity, the clinical capacity of the dental health aide. In that case, as you can see, they're referred to, I'll get this up here, they're referred to a hub. This is a very simplistic model that gets a bit headier when we begin to use standard flow charting, which is the guts of the simulation model, to trace the movement of patients through the oral health delivery system. We try to describe as much as we can exactly what happens every step of the way. The decision rules that we've come up with for this have been vetted by the oral health practitioners mostly in the Bethel area, but throughout the state and with Ron's staff. And so we get a combination of best guess, which we know in medical care is in some instances the best you get, but at least they are consciously confirmed or adjusted by the oral health professionals. And last, using this, we're able to see what happens over a longer period of time. So here's an oral health delivery system model that looks like a flowchart that you've seen, any kind of flowchart. You don't need to look at this. It has processes and data collection and things that happen, decision points along the system. And having this conceptual model that builds up from Ron's stripped-down model to our basic idea, this was reviewed at incredibly great length by a lot of the oral health staff. So we knew that we had a starting spot. This is not what it looks like in any logic.
Well, in a discrete event model, the system can take the form of a flowchart. And so that's what we did. We mostly translated this flowchart that we came up with, which actually co-evolved with this one. And this one is a little bit more complex. It has a little bit more of the technical detail, such as over on the left side of the screen. You can see generators for the initial population and for births in the population, in migration and out migration. And the other main visible difference is that it flows from left to right instead of top to bottom. But the general flow is the same. It's a cycle. It kind of flows through the chain of care-seeking behavior, where they would seek care, whether there is a dental health aid available in the village or an itinerant dentist available, and to the where they receive care, and whether there is any follow-up care needed, or whether they need to be referred to the hub clinic. And they flow back from the far right back to the beginning. And there's kind of a...
I think you might be able to use it on that piece of cardboard.
There's kind of a central holding point almost where the population sort of stays until they emerge on a kind of a monthly basis to go through the flow of the system. And if they decide not to seek care, then they simply return directly to the village. So this is one part of it. The other part is the state of the model. The flowchart describes the movement of the patients through the system, but it doesn't describe the health of the population. So each person in this simulated population is modeled individually and stores its own internal state, which consists mainly of it's the number of decayed, missing, and filled teeth, both primary and permanent teeth, age, and history of treatment, along with a number of other variables. And another thing that happens sort of outside the flowchart is the outreach activities performed by the dental health aide, such as education in schools and for new mothers.
We, as I said before, they're not graphic user interfaces. They're not really GUIs, so we don't have sliders per se. But keep it in your mind as if it were that. There are six basic categories of sliders. These are ways that we can change the parameters of the model so that you can test different characteristics of a system. The first is what I had described earlier called model tuning. And these are the our understanding of the relationship between what you do and what you get that comes from the oral health literature. Well, sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. And we spent a good bit of time fussing with the model to make sure that it really lined up with the way oral health is provided in Alaska. The second is care-seeking behavior, or patient flow includes care-seeking behavior, the proportion of people that have urgent care and the like. Staffing, which I mentioned earlier, is the scope of service, work patterns, queuing capacity. The treatment scenario, as Ben said, there is an awful lot of preventive dentistry that goes on, community outreach and the like. Treatment responses, to a large extent, they're all literature-based. And last, because it was a big deal, the Medicaid enrollment and Medicaid reimbursement modules. Now, we won't see those a lot in the simulations that we'll be running today, but they are in there, and you can see in the outputs that Ben will show you shortly that the Medicaid capture rate is there.
So this is just so you can see what it looks like, this is the actual input file. It's an Excel spreadsheet. And most of the parameters are in the treatment response category, and they take the form of percentage reductions to decay rate as a result of various treatments. And this is a screenshot of what you see as the model is running. I had a video of it. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to want to play on this computer. But this is it shows at the top in the scatter plot a point for every individual in the simulated population. And on the x-axis is the age of the person. On the y-axis is their oral health by some measure, and it's which measure they're plotted with is controlled by the selection on the upper right hand corner.
Is it okay if I do a Vanna White thing?
Sure. So you can choose to see DMFT or decayed missing and filled teeth, filled and sound teeth, T health, or whether or not the person is caries free, which just ends up looking like two sort of dotted lines because it's either one or zero. Below that, the dark kind of greenish bars are just the average of that measure over the age group that's delimited by the vertical lines. Below those bars are the average reduction to decay, the baseline decay rate for each age group. To the right is the percentage of the orange and red bars are the percentage of the population or of children that have early childhood caries or severe ECC. And directly below that are counters that that get incremented whenever one of these services is provided. And in the very bottom right corner is the time counter, and this measures the model time in simulated years. You can see it's almost to year four at this point, and there's no dental health aid currently in the system because they come in at year six. And toward the bottom, there are also a number of other variables that change as the model runs, such as the population, the number of people seeking care, the number of people who have received outreach, number of people waiting to see the dentist or the dental health aide. And so as the model runs, you see all this moving forward. All the points will be moving to the right. And the output is written to an Excel file and then graphed. This is one of the graphs that's generated. It tracks two groups based on their year zero age. The orange lines represent kids under five, and the green lines represent people 20 to 25. The dotted lines represent the existing system, their oral health under the existing system with no dental health aid. And the solid line is with the dental health aid. With the DMFT measure, lower is better. And so you can see that around year six, the lines start to diverge. And the scenarios with the dental health aid, those populations see improved oral health. Right. This is another one of the graphs, and this shows among the children aged 5 to 18. This is in the scenario with the dental health aide entering at year 6. You can see that at that time, the number receiving outreach jumps up to 90% because of the outreach activities of the dental health aide. And also the number who have received clinic-based care, and although slightly delayed, you can see that there's an increasing number of children who have no decay. This is the same graph, but for the adults, and this is a result of the prioritization in the queues of children. Obviously, they're not receiving as much care, particularly the outreach, because most of that in the model is school-based. So we learned a few things building this model, in many ways, discrete event modeling was a pretty good match for this oral health system. It's representable by a flow chart, which is a good descriptor of the way patients flow through a system. It has structures such as queues, where the patients have to wait to receive care. It allows us to easily schedule an amount of time that an event will take, such as the average appointment time. It allows us to compare alternative structures by changing the parameters and running the model again, and then comparing the output. It's a detail-based approach in that it's based on putting together a large number of treatments, each of which has a different level of benefit. However, it can become pretty complex. It's difficult to hold an intuitive grasp of the entire model in your head, which is unlike some simpler mathematical models. It's difficult to calibrate and verify because of the sheer number of parameters and decision rules. And all of these can be sources for error. So it requires a lot of attention. And unfortunately, we didn't get as far as performing a lot of verification of the model results. But the exercise of creating the model really helps to understand the system. And I think this is true for modeling and discrete event modeling in particular. This can be of as much value as the end result itself, and so it's very helpful when the client for whom you're building the model is involved in the process of developing it. I think that's it.
Any questions, Oscar?
Just
on an annual basis versus dentists entering or retiring over the 20 years.
Just one. It models only one dental health aide who enters the village in year 6 and then gets promoted at some point along the line to an enhanced scope of practice, level 2 dental health aide.
But it wouldn't be that difficult to expand this to any number of villages, all of which have populations that can be described, each of which apparently now the competition is on, want to have or already have a dental health aide, each of whom is supervised to some extent by a dentist operating out of a hub community that has referrals, both supervisory and referral treatment responsibilities. So you can puff this up pretty quickly into a series of village-based models operating independently that feed into a hub model and come from there into a tertiary care oral health system. We didn't get that far. All we know is that we think that we may have been able to do it at one village level, but you can see that it has a potential of being expandable.
Are you guys going to follow this research project?
We hope to be able to publish the model, but we're running into some software licensing issues that we hope to have resolved sometime soon, but it has to do with not being able to distribute the model because of the license of the software we use to create it. But we do have some stuff published online, and I guess I could put that address up on the screen here. I'll just type it here. So our intent is to publish the model software on that site as well, but currently it has kind of a background introduction, a user's guide to the model, and a technical appendix describing the benefits received from the different types of treatment. No, I don't think we haven't even looked in detail into expanding the model. But that would be an interesting application, and would probably require a lot more to use this this modeling technique would require a lot more computing power, because as it is, this village of 1,000 people takes probably 5 minutes to run, and so it would require either a much bigger computer or a simpler version of the model, I guess.
In terms of modeling the activities, how much of the prevention or treatment activities were separated in terms of activity instance?
Well, this one is just models the primary dental health aide, not the dental health aide therapist.
Oh, okay.
So there's not it's mostly preventive care, but every procedure, you know, whether it's a fluoride or distributing xylitol gum or providing sealants, has is provided individually and has a separate parameter describing the benefit of that procedure.
The reason actually I was asking that question was I was actually surprised to see there were such a small differences in terms of with the aid model and the without aid model in terms of DMFT. And one of the nature of the DMFT index is it doesn't really differentiate between the current disease and the previous disease.
Right.
So maybe I was thinking that was one of the reasons, but if you focus only on prevention, hopefully we wanted to see, you know, more of the people.
Right, and that's one of the reasons we chose to make it an option to look at different measures of oral health that might be a little bit more informative, like T-health, and those, I think. I don't think actually I showed you any graphs of the other measures, but you can see, I think the two other graphs may have been more informative in terms of the difference before and after the dental health aid in showing the increase in the number of children that are caries free and and so on.
What's included in T-Health?
T-Health, I think, is a weighted, it's somewhat like DMFT, except instead of just the sum, it's a weighted average or a weighted sum. And so I basically, a decayed tooth is given a higher score, for example, than a missing tooth, I think. So it's basically just scored to be a little bit more informative.
You have to back there. No, the one in the back. Then
I was just wondering if there was any parameter of cost
built
into the
walking. We did put in a preliminary total Medicaid reimbursement counter, and that was sort of in the middle of the screenshot. That's the only place you could really see it, but we did put in Medicaid reimbursement amounts for the various procedures, and kind of added them on based on what we could find out about the likely eligibility of the population. What the total Medicaid reimbursements would have been, but that's pretty much all we did. No, we didn't do anything like that in this model.
But it could be done using the outputs to an Excel spreadsheet, so you could look at the difference between Medicaid reimbursements with a DHA and Medicaid reimbursements without one?
I guess, yeah, you could look at the output data and make your own calculations based on that. Yes?
Larry,
Can I ask you, are the models meant to be read comparatively or literally? And if literally, is there something like a confidence interval one can use to make a
No, it's unfortunately a lot fuzzier than that. And we would probably discourage even using it quantitatively. It's more of seeing how much different changes will affect the outcomes. And that's simply because there's so many possible points for error that we can't know how much the difference really is going to be.
Yeah,
yeah.
Larry?
I want to go back to a political question. So
okay. To the other. Okay, yeah, any questions for any of the other panelists?
Since the suit was settled, there was a American Dental Association Access to Care Summit on for Native Alaskan and Native Americans, I believe, and I think you took part in that. In addition, while the evaluation piece is going on, you all are, I assume, continuing to train new people to continue to expand the program. Can you comment, and also that this has been a very big, I'm not sure that a lot of folks recognize how big of a story this has been on Alaska, in the Alaska media, that this, as I understand it, has received a lot of coverage in the Alaska media. Can you comment on the ongoing reception? I mean, I know there haven't been patient complaints, but the ongoing reception, like what's the relationship at this point with organized dentistry at the Alaska Dental Association? What's happening as a result of the ADA summit? Are there some things going to continue to go on? Is there sort of an opening of the minds of the model from organized dentistry? Is the community at large, more and more receptive to the program? And what's the plan if all of a sudden the evaluation would say, oh, this program is terrible?
Just a first remark, can you all hear me? That it's interesting that in Alaska, my test is when I get an Alaska Airlines flight and fly up there, and if people find out what I'm doing, doesn't matter who it is, the fishermen, everybody says, you know, that is the best thing. No one was out there. The tribe should be able to do whatever they want to do. And we all have a dental health issue. So the public was hugely impacted by this, I think, in a very, and actually got them much more aware about oral health issues than they would before, probably for themselves as well. So it's a lot of good collateral damage. Now you talk about the
Indians. Oh, we're all getting along fine. you know, I think things have definitely changed. I mean, I think there has been, you know, some movement, at least in a direction to being more open to some of these conversations. At that summit, at the American Indian and Alaska Native Health Summit that the ABA sponsored, there was a lot of discussion about dental therapists and the need to do something, and it got down to, you know, what's your definition of a mid-level provider and who should supervise them and that sort of thing. And I think they are beginning to recognize that there needs to be some changes, and there's a lot going on in Minnesota right now, and I think that's sort of taken a lot of the heat off of, of Alaska. But I also do think that things are slowly improving, and I think change is inevitable, and I think it's happening, maybe not as fast as we like, but it's happening.
One more question, yeah?
I'm also from Alaska, but I think another interesting response to that is that legislation was passed our last session that expanded protections for dental assistants and dental hygienists. And one of the bills was sponsored by the Alaska Dental Society, but it's not, but for legislative action. And interesting, in a few places I've heard responses, dentists didn't even realize the bill was going before the legislature nor that it had passed. And so I think the larger question seems to be, there need to be more practitioners. And how is the service going to be increased? And this seems, in some ways, a statement on the part of the Alaska Dental Society that says, we recognize there's more, but we're going to make another statement. So I don't know if you have any comments.
Yeah, some progress. Our state was a state that, there wasn't expanded function auxiliaries allowed in the state of Alaska, and so now we've got that legislation in place. And I mentioned part of my program was adopting the Indian Health Service expanded functions program because there was a lot of interest in dentists working in our, safety net clinics and tribal clinics to have expanded function dental auxiliary to increase efficiency. And that's something, I guess, this is really gets back to the irreversible procedures. They see that as, I think organized dentistry looks at expanded function dental assistance as falling on the side of the line that doesn't include irreversible procedures. And so we've made some progress that way. I don't know if we're going to get across the line sooner or later, but I'm hopeful that that'll happen.
I had the privilege of representing the Oral Health Section of FDHA at the meeting in Albuquerque, outside of Albuquerque. And for a couple of days there, we really didn't talk about the DHAT program. And I got up, and there was a lot of folks in the room, from the Dental Hygiene Association and so forth. And so I got up in the room, and I said, there's one thing we've not been talking about, and that's IP. And the hygienist thought, oh my God, he's not going to talk about independent practices. and it was about irreversible procedures. And I think a lot of the dentists that I was sitting with were really taken aback by the various groups. There were several different tables, and they came up with their own boards of ideas. They were very surprised that a lot of the groups thought that the DHAT program was the best thing that had happened for this population in Alaska. The dentists were flawed. They didn't realize that was a good thing. And so it was a very useful educational process, I think, that the put on by Gary Bashoon, who's an oral health section member of APHA, as as well as women from the ADA. He was very good about bringing everybody in, and I think there are further efforts in that regard. So, I think it was Mark Twain that said that soap and education are not as sudden as a massacre, but are more deadly in the long run, meaning that education is going to change culture, and not everybody wants to see culture changed, whether it's the culture of traditional organized dentistry or the Native American culture.
The last question.
I wonder if I could just look forward to the obvious stage.
I hope so.
Australia began using dental therapists in the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. So it's 40 years on. What's the situation now? Simply that dentistry, dental hygiene, and dental therapy are fully integrated in their training and in their practice. All three practice in schools, they practice in community health centers, and practice in private practice. There is no controversy. The dentists have learned a lot. It's obvious there now.
That's good to know.
I think you're well headed down that road.
I would agree with John. I think from the medical side, the nurse practitioner movement is a good model. They work very nicely with physicians. Patients like them better than physicians. They consume less often, and their outcomes are every bit as good. I sometimes wonder why the dental profession can't look at the medical profession and say it works.
We hope they get it eventually.
Right?
We hope they eventually get it.
Can I add something about that? Because, the physicians of the nurse practitioner, I'm not sure that it's an exact parallel, exact comparison, because of the irreversible procedure thing. Okay? I think the VHAT program trains people to provide the same level of care as dentists because of the scope of practice that they provide. But what the equivalent in there is no equivalent in physician services. It's the equivalent of surgical services. So where are the surgical practitioners, the nurse practitioners? And I would argue that in medicine, it's ridiculous to train a hand surgeon by making him go or her go through medical school, through a general surgery residency, through a plastics program, and then specializing in hand surgery, when all they're going to do is hand surgery. It's the equivalent of the surgical approach to treating teeth. We waste so much money in healthcare in training these super specialized surgeons who then charge the earth for their services.
Right.
I'm off on a tangent. I
realize. You're right, Howard, that the nurse practitioners don't do anything irreversible, but to the level of their training, they know when they're going beyond their level of training, whatever that may be, and they refer, ask for help, whatever.
Howard, nurse anesthetists do things that are very fundamentally irreversible.
Yeah. Radiograph. I mean, what's more non-reversible than X-ray? And please, dentistry lets anybody, take X-ray. So, it is, as somebody said earlier, it's what reimbursable. Yes.
Well, thank you very much for all the discussion. Have been very interesting. Thank you to the presenters, but we have to bring the session to a close. And don't forget about filling the continuing education credits there in the back. Thank you very much. That was
very
interesting.
Yeah.
Modeling, yes.
Yeah, it was a nice contrast of the three topics.
Oh, yeah. It was fun. It was fun.
And the question is, does your governor have a position on this program?
She has a position on everything. It's only a matter of time.
Thank God my practitioner didn't.
No, but you had. So I was at.
Again, not predictive.
So with that,
The question is,
this is what you look like when you were the
day. That's what I was looking at, how much you guys look alike.
Really?
Together. I mean, I have
the economic bureau.
Labor's division of Bureau of Labor
Statistics. I think so.
And then I compare that with this population growth.
So you, I mean, I'm sure you know L. Jackson Brown, the NEA. He actually published, I'm pretty sure that Dissertational is one of the NEA publications. And it was a dissertation done in a three-paper model, so he had three papers, and one of those is actually an economic model for that. And I have a hard copy, borrowed copy from my library, but I can give you the reference.
The reference, I'll find it, yeah.
Or you can watch that flowchart. Transactions flying through there 20 years.
And in Missouri, we did it something very loosely in that regard. I've got a presentation tomorrow. It's not a simulation model.
Okay.
It's more of a taking your epidemiological data, taking your current practice patterns, and projecting the needs if everybody actually accessed care.
Okay.
And then if you keep the current productivity and team composition intact, how many data you need. And then we mapped it. So the presentation is mainly on the map, but we have the model. I mean, it's not as sophisticated. We're writing.
Okay, fine.
Great.
Okay. So I'll send you an email. And your one child.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
What time are you going to finish tomorrow?
12:30.
Okay.
I think it's the last session.
Okay. I'll be here for sure.
All right. Take care.
Is this yours?
I don't know. No, I think somebody else. Yeah.
Ben. This is yours.
I know.
Oh, thanks.
I know.
Thanks again, Ben.
Well, we're there.
Yeah.